I want to welcome you to another lesson in the Lead Yourself First program. I'm Tom Cooper, and I'm really glad you've joined me today for this lesson. Today we're talking about how do you improve your connection to people at work. Lead Yourself First is your personal growth program. Zig Ziglar said, you can have anything you want in life if you help enough other people get what they want. And Lead Yourself First is your system to help you find and start using the tools that can help you help others get what they want so you can get what you want. I work hard to make sure that each of these lessons is able to stand on its own, that each one has practical, interesting, and entertaining information so that you could take even one of these lessons and make it your focus for a season to help you develop mastery in a single area. This lesson, like each lesson, is designed to bring you the best information and ideas I can find on these topics so you can use what we talk about to get you better results. This program is designed to help you move up the ladder, too, to gain influence and respect among your team members and your leaders so that you're seen as a catalyst to make good things happen with your team. I believe in you. I believe in your dream to grow, and I know there's a ton of potential inside you that can be unlocked and deliver results. And Lead Yourself First is based on the idea that each player on the team has the ability to stretch and grow. And if you start right where you are, you might be astonished at what can happen. Now, before we jump in, I always like to talk about how are you going to act at the end of this lesson? What can you apply? What can you change? What could you teach? Take an idea from the lesson. Start to use it. Change something that you're doing. You'll never change your life until you change something you do every day. And teach. Be a river, not a reservoir. We want to be able to share with others the things that we're learning as we're learning them. I've been looking forward to today's lesson. I look forward to it because I have learned through, oh my goodness, painful personal experience, what happens if we overlook the human side of work. And I look forward to today's lesson because I know that if I can leave you with just a few key ideas and you use them, you're going to be able to achieve in weeks what it took me years to learn how to do. Now, over the next few minutes, we're going to unpack some ideas that are going to be very useful. If you will put them into practice, you will be shocked at all the things you're able to do. And maybe for you, you're going to want to dig in to have tools and accountability to make this happen faster or more predictably. And I promise at the end of the lesson, I'm going to share with you a way to do that. Fair enough? Now, when it comes to our success at work, did you know that 87% of our success has to do with people skills? 87%! If you're not investing in your connection with other people, I guarantee you it is harming your effectiveness. Now, today's lesson, we have three big ideas that we want to cover. One, human connection is the heart of all productive work. Two, people work is the work. It's the work. Tasks are really secondary. And three, six ways to make a connection with other people. Now, I work with senior leaders in organizations all the time. If there's one thing I hear the most frequently, it's why can't people just do their jobs? Why can't people do their job? I hear this over and over again. And why can't they? Because we don't value them highly enough to invest in them or even invest in ourselves. And regardless of your position or your role, you have the ability to make a difference in the lives of the people you work with. If you can communicate value to others, you're going to find they're more willing to deliver for you. Now, I have a confession to make. I am an extrovert, but man, do I love getting tasks just knocked out. It gives me great joy to take something that was on my to-do list and mark it done. And on the other hand, it is a gut punch when I think something is done and it turns out not to be done. It makes me crazy. And especially when it goes right back on my to-do list. And I love getting stuff done so much that, well, it often gets in the way of my relationship with other people. I can recall, to my embarrassment, how many times I've been in a situation where I focused so much on getting tasks done that I've stomped on people. It's terrible. The bigger problem with this is that studies show that the people stuff is more important than the tasks. That's why 87%. Human connection is the heart of all productive work. And I found that when I invested in connecting with my team members, it dramatically improved my effectiveness. And then when I focused on checking tasks off my to-do list and I ignored the personness of the people on my team, my productivity fell. When I took care of the people, they took care of the tasks, and everybody was more productive and happier. Now, kindness is valuable. You may have outdoor clothing that you wear that's made from polar tech or polar fleece. And the company that makes these materials is called Malden Mills. And the owner of the company is a deeply religious man named Aaron Feierstein. On December 31st, 1995, his factory caught fire and burned to the ground. The factory employed 3,400 workers and was the main employer for two neighboring towns. Now, the area once had many mills, but most had closed and moved to areas where they could pay people less money to work. And Mr. Feierstein felt that people should be paid a decent wage, and so he wouldn't move his factory. The fire occurred on his 70th birthday. The workers believed it was the end of the line for their job. Surely Mr. Feierstein would take the $300 million in insurance money and call it quits. But while the smoke was still rising from the charred remains of the fire, Mr. Feierstein called his workers together at a school gymnasium to speak with them. They were about to discover what kind of man they worked for. He announced he would not abandon them. He was going to rebuild the factory. He told them he was keeping all 3,400 of them on the payroll for 1 month, and that each of them was going to get a $275 Christmas bonus. Once the factory was rebuilt, they would get their jobs back. Grown men wept in the audience as he spoke. After the first month ended, he paid them for a second month. After the second month ended, he paid them for a third month. It cost him $1.5 million a week to do this. He also paid their hospitalization insurance. His employees responded by salvaging what equipment they could, and in temporary buildings, they got production up to what it was before the fire while the new factory was being built. Mr. Feierstein received much praise from around the country, but he said he did only what was the moral and right thing to do. He used his money to support his beliefs in God rather than make money his God. As each of you lives your life, try to remember Mr. Feierstein's example and treat people you encounter with fairness and with kindness. You'll be amazed at how good you feel and how much better you'll be treated in return. Mr. Feierstein valued people over profits, and he's not alone. The statistics show that nice guys actually get the best out of their subordinates. Of the 16,000 executives that were studied, 13% were identified as high achievers, and those high achievers tended to care about people as well as profits. They tended to view subordinates optimistically rather than pessimistically. They sought advice from the team and they listened well. It's not that Feierstein didn't care about profits. It's that he valued people highly and he was willing to sacrifice in the short term for the long-term outcomes. And that's something we can all consider. There's good data in the research on how being people-focused can make a big difference in teamwork, in productivity, in engagement, and morale. And building a positive work environment where we care about our team members, it pays. When it comes to the way that people operate, John Dewey said, the deepest urge in human nature is the desire to be important. The deepest urge in human nature is the desire to be important. The desire to be important. This is such a big deal that most of Dale Carnegie's, award-winning, best-selling, incredibly successful, valuable, useful, helpful book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, is focused on tools and techniques to address that need that we have to be important. Now, I want to take just a few minutes to share with you some gems from Carnegie's book. This need to be valued by others, it often goes unmet. Many people are going through life with this need unmet, and it causes them to make choices that lead them to bad outcomes. Thoreau said, the mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation. Most people are unfulfilled and they long for appreciation. Do you want to be a person who's able to get the most from other people? Learning to address this core need will give you a serious edge. Philosopher William James said, the deepest principle in human nature is the craving to be appreciated. Carnegie actually said, here is a gnawing and unfaltering human hunger, and the rare individual who honestly satisfies this heart hunger will hold people in the palm of his or her hand. I'm just going to repeat that. Here is a gnawing and unfaltering human hunger, and the rare individual who honestly satisfies this heart hunger will hold people in the palm of his or her hand. Just think about that. If you can honestly satisfy the heart hunger of others, you could hold them in the palm of your hand. And this has proven true over and over and over and over again. One of the first employees in U.S. history to be paid over $1 million a year was a man by the name of Charles Schwab. Now, why did they pay him that much money? In 1921, that was insane. Schwab said his salary was based on his ability to deal with people. He said, "I consider my ability to arouse enthusiasm among my people the greatest asset I possess. And the way to develop the best that is in a person is by appreciation and encouragement. There is there is nothing else that so kills the ambitions of a person as criticisms from superiors." Schwab said, "In my wide association of life, meeting with the many and great people in various parts of the world, I have yet to find the person who did not do better work and put forth greater effort under a spirit of approval than under a spirit of criticism. Kindness is valuable. It's more productive than criticism." Back when I was 19 years old, I was working as a server in a restaurant, and there were several managers in the restaurant, and they each took their turn overseeing operations, and most of them were not like Charles Schwab. I often remember hearing, "If you got time to lean, you got time to clean," as if that was some sort of inspirational message from on high. Now, in general, I was a decent worker. I was polite. I showed up on time for work and had happy customers almost all the time. I was decent at my job, and I had a decent reputation. And late one evening, a group of about 15 or maybe 20, I don't know, people were seated in my section of the restaurant, and I was scrambling for the next couple of hours to take orders, refill drinks, make sure everybody had everything they needed. I was really busy all at once, and so I decided I was going to take a shortcut. Now, typically, I would clear dishes from the table, and I would run them back to the kitchen, the dishwasher area, as we would deliver the appetizers or entrees, desserts, or coffees. But this evening, I was tired. And I decided I would set up a tray in the server station, and I would pile up the plates. And over time, that stack of plates and cups and silverware got higher. And being efficient, I decided I would rearrange them to make them more effectively stacked up. And by the time that table of guests left, I collected my tip. Well, there was a veritable mountain of dishes piled high on that tray. It was definitely the biggest stack of dishes I had ever created in my time as a server. So I made another choice. Rather than carry the dirty dishes a few at a time to the kitchen, I tried to lift the whole thing and make one single trip from the wait stand over to the kitchen. It really was a continuation of my theme of cutting corners. I mean, why waste all that energy on multiple trips? Now, the restaurant management wanted to impress upon us how expensive it was for us to cause problems or waste. In fact, they had a wall-sized diagram right next to the dishwashing station with an outline of each plate, cup, saucer, and everything else. And in bold print, they had the price of the item. They just didn't want us to lose or throw away or even break the plates. Well, as I squatted down next to the heaping tray of plates, I used all of my young leg and back muscles to lift the tray and heft it up to a balance point on my shoulder and one arm. I carefully navigated my way from the remote corner of the restaurant to the dishwashing station. Arriving in the kitchen, I began to use my free hand to set up a tray stand on which I planned to place the heavy tray. The flick of my wrist to deploy the tray stand was just the off-balance input the tray needed. I can remember in slow motion watching in horror as I saw the stack of dessert plates on the very edge of the front of the tray slip and then fall off the front of the heavy tray. And as the stoneware plates began their descent toward the tile floor, this small shift in the weight distribution was enough to cause the barely balanced heavy tray to tip over backwards, and I was powerless to stop what has now become the inevitable. Dozens of plates met their demise on the merciless hard tile floor below, and the noise was astonishingly loud. So here I was tired, sweaty, and surrounded by sharp, broken, dirty plates on the floor all around my feet. I began picking up the broken pieces and putting them in the trash can, and it did take me quite a while to get through the debris, and only a plate or two was salvageable from the entire stack. And about the time that I was maybe three quarters of the way done picking up the plate pieces from the floor, I heard the door to the office slam shut. I knew at that moment that my manager was on her way to discuss with me what had occurred. And I was in big trouble. I had made a very foolish choice, and I had been solely responsible for hundreds of dollars worth of plates that were destroyed on the floor in front of me. And the manager on duty that night, she was one that I particularly liked. I learned some lessons from her, and I certainly was about to learn a lesson. I wasn't sure whether she'd still like me after what I'd done, and I don't know whether she had studied Dale Carnegie's material, but as she approached me, she looked at me solemnly, and she asked, "Did what I think just happened happen?" I was too terrified to speak. I nodded. What was about to happen? I mean, she had me dead to rights. There was no escaping, no excusing what I'd done. What would she do? Would I lose my job? Would I have to pay for the plates? She looked at me, and she said quietly and firmly, "Let's not let that happen again. Okay?" And then she turned and walked away. I never heard another word from her again about that. I was stunned. Her mercy toward me was amazing. I was grateful. She didn't approach me with a spirit of criticism. How do you think that affected my opinion of her? What do you think happened the next time she needed something from me? I can tell you that for the whole time I was working there, I was always grateful for her kindness. I knew how stupid I had been, and I knew the consequences to the company. And being yelled at, which every other manager would have done quickly, would not have had the same impact on me as her quiet comments did. That was many, many years ago, and I still remember that moment. She showed me kindness when I definitely needed it, and I've never forgotten that moment or how I felt when it happened. Kindness over criticism, it's incredibly effective. Remember what Schwab said, that people do better work and put forth greater effort under a spirit of approval? So what can we do to create a spirit of approval? Well, this is simple, but it's not easy. Look for ways to catch them doing something right. Look for ways to catch them doing something right. And I want to point this out on purpose here. It is not enough to see it and acknowledge that it was right in your mind. You need to say it out loud. Say it out loud. Be specific. Be clear. Be vocal. That's what Dale Carnegie talks about in his book, and it's what Ken Blanchard talks about in his book, Whale Done. Blanchard notes that when it comes to training the whales at SeaWorld, the trainers ignore all negative behaviors, and praise and reward only the positive ones. Time-tested, this positivity approach works with these amazing ocean animals, and it works with a human animal, too. What can you do to catch people doing something right? How can you begin to notice the good things they're doing? How can you recognize and appreciate them for their contributions, no matter how small they may seem to be at the time? It requires that you make it a priority to look for them doing it right, not look for them doing it wrong. And when you see something, say something. Bob Berg says, all things being equal, people do business with people they know, like, and trust. It's not that you have to be liked, it's just that it makes things easier if people like you. I don't have at my command the time to teach this principle in depth during this lesson, but I want to share with you six ways to make a connection with your team members. Dale Carnegie says, 1, become genuinely interested in other people. Become genuinely interested in other people. 2, smile. Smile. 3, remember that a man's name is to him the sweetest and most important sound in any language. Remember that a man's name is to him the sweetest and most important sound in any language. 4, be a good listener. Be a good listener. Encourage others to talk about themselves. That's what everybody's favorite subject is, themselves. 5, talk in terms of the other man's interest. Talk in terms of the other man's interest. And 6, make the person feel important and do it sincerely. Now, of these six, I want to make a moment to talk about 6, because I think it ties in nicely with the Charles Schwab quotes that I've been sharing in the lesson. How in the world can you make another person feel important? I've never met anyone who would get up in the morning to do lousy work and set a goal of making other people angry. And yet we find ourselves feeling like that is exactly what the other person's been intending to do. But if you realize that no one starts out with a goal to be bad at their jobs or to intend to make you angry, it can help you to start to look for the good things that they are doing. Mary Kay Ash, the founder of Mary Kay Cosmetics, said, "Pretend that every single person you meet has a sign around their neck that says, 'Make me feel important.' Not only will you succeed in sales, you will succeed in life. Even the most unimportant person can be important to your business." I want to close this lesson with a story about Bob and the impact one conversation had on a business. Ron Burley told this story in Inc. magazine. Ron says, "In business, we're often all about the numbers, occasionally to a fault. I'm not saying statistics and metrics aren't useful tools. Sometimes, however, the success or failure of an enterprise comes down to individual interactions, say a handshake or a phone call. Let me give you a good example." Ron says, "In 1995, I bootstrapped a tech company, Broadcast Software. We created digital audio and automation software for broadcast radio stations. After 4 years, we had 16 employees, and we had customers in 40 countries. But we were at a transition point. If companies need to grow or die, we were in need of a transfusion. We had grown beyond my ability to fund future growth out of my back pocket, and it was time to get outside capital. It also turned out to be time for the tech bubble to burst. Our potential funding sources instantly disappeared. I was a hands-on CEO. I had written the original code, and I knew many of our customers personally. I had told my employees the buck stops with me, and I'd be willing to speak with any customer they couldn't help or satisfy. If need be, they should even give out my personal phone number. So, when my cell phone vibrated at 2 a.m. on a Sunday morning, I recognized the 618 area code as Southern Illinois. That meant that the caller was Bob, a crusty, old-time radio engineer and owner of a very small rural radio station near Mount Vernon. He'd purchased one of our systems several months before and had been struggling to get it set up. Bob's biggest problem? He had never used a computer before. My support manager more than once had recommended that we just refund Bob's money, but we had marketed our products as easy to use, and so we couldn't abandon someone just because they found otherwise. I climbed out of bed, closed the bedroom door behind me, and spent the next 2 hours coaching Bob on how to configure the startup options for Microsoft Windows. It wasn't an issue with our software, but it was a problem for our customer, Bob, which made it our problem. At the end of the conversation, I thought we'd made a lot of progress. Bob was enthusiastic. I was hopeful. And that was the last that anyone heard from Bob. He didn't call tech support. He didn't call me. As time passed, I wondered whether we'd actually fixed the problem or whether he had just given up. I made a mental note to check in on him as soon as I'd figured out the bigger financial issues. Well, one situation was about to solve the other. Almost 6 months to the day after I'd hung up the phone with Bob, I received another call. The chief of engineering of a major media company informed me that the company had decided to standardize on our software across its entire chain of more than 300 radio stations. It would be the biggest order in our entire history, more than $4 million. It would easily provide the capital we had been needing so desperately. That call was a complete surprise. We'd not pursued their business. In fact, it had been public knowledge they were selecting one of our competitors. And as it turns out, the reason for their mid-course change was Bob. That phone call with Bob saved our company. He hadn't given up on us. He loved us. Shortly after my call with him, that same media giant made an offer he couldn't refuse to purchase his radio station, and Bob had stayed on as a consulting engineer. Not long after, a company meeting centered on their intentions to purchase our competitor's products. Bob raised his hand in the back of the room and said, "Have you ever heard of Broadcast Software?" He told his new colleagues the story of our phone call and how we had stuck with him for months, even when the problems were not really ours. Over lunch and then dinner, Bob sang our praises. At the end of the evening, he scribbled our website and contact information on a cocktail napkin and handed it to the chief of engineering. "Check these guys out," he said. "They're great." They did, and the rest was history, our history. There's a moral to the story. Every customer needs to be treated with respect, and no customer should be left dissatisfied. I'm not saying that every customer call is crucially important, but some of them certainly are, and you never know which one might be your Bob. Ron had made Bob feel important enough for a two-hour call from 2 a.m. to 4 a.m. on a Sunday to help him solve a problem he was having and get him through it. All right, it's about time for your personal action plan. I want to share with you today's closing thought. We're going to do a quick review of what we talked about. First, why can't people just do their dang job? Charles Schwab said, I have yet to find the person who did not do better work and put forth greater effort under a spirit of approval than under a spirit of criticism. Human connection is the heart of all productive work. The people are the work we are to do, and we need to remember that. When we take care of the people, the tasks take care of themselves. Kindness is one way to establish loyalty in your people. It builds relationships and helps them to feel really cared for. That restaurant manager, she instilled a deep loyalty in me, and I've never forgotten how she made me feel. What can you do to catch them doing something right? And when you do, can you say it out loud? We talked about six ways to make people like you, and one of them is to make the other person feel important and to do that sincerely. That's what Ron did with Bob, and it won him a $4 million contract. So what about you? What can you apply, change, or teach? What idea from today's lesson will you put into practice this week? I mentioned that you might be interested in learning more or having some accountability and resources to support you, and if that's you, I've got a 4-session mastermind coaching program on John Maxwell's little book, Relationships 101. This book encapsulates John's philosophy about people, the philosophy that inspired me to become a better team member and a better leader. The cost for this coaching program is $249 a person, and in these 4 sessions, you will dive into the core of relationships that can propel your work forward. It's a don't-miss program filled with practical ideas. I love that content. If this sounds interesting to you, drop me an email, tom@brighthillgroup.com, tom@brighthillgroup.com, and we'll get it set up. Thank you for being here for today's Lead Yourself First lesson, and I look forward to hearing from you next time.